Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, and joining me today is Laureate for Irish Fiction, Éilis na Gcuimhne. I just wanted to bring you back to when you were a child. I mean, I know from reading your work and from reading interviews with you that I know your dad was from Donegal and that folklore has been a large part of your background, but was that like evident in your childhood? Can you remember, like, are there really early memories of stories for you?
No, not really. I as you say, my dad was from the Gaeltacht in Donegal, but I don't remember him telling folk tales or legends or anything, although he was a good narrator, just a raconteur about his own life working. He was a carpenter. So I didn't really get interested in folklore. It's a little bit boring in a way until I discovered it in University College Dublin when I was studying Old and Middle English and did a module on the folktale in medieval literature in 1972, I think. And that introduced me to the whole world of the folk tale and the relationship between oral stories and written literature and so on. But no, the stories that I was introduced to as a child were in books.
By your mother, would she have been the one reading to you?
Yes, she read to me and my brother and sister. And I actually have some of the books from my early childhood, amazingly, since I can't find some of the books, you know, that were published 2 years ago. The first one I remember her reading was this one, Heidi, by Joanna Spiri. And I have this copy of it. I illustrated it.
Oh my goodness.
Any illustrations. And my mother used to read a chapter every night to me and my siblings. And then she went on and read What Katie Did was another one I remember, and The Coral Island and Alice in Wonderland. And they were always in these Dean and Son Edinburgh, I think they're called Blackie books. Gent and Sons, rather. Ludgate Hill, London. I always thought they were Edinburgh somehow, but they were very cheap editions of the classics, for children's classics. And they were the only books that we owned. So that was the start. Then after a while, of course, I learned to read myself. And I remember quite vividly, it was like one dramatic moment that I moved from not reading to reading independently, though obviously the school system, I'd been reading The Cat and the Mat and whatever, because this was when I was 6 or 7. I wasn't by any means a very young reader. I read a story in a storybook and it was called The Fairy Ring. I can remember the story sitting on my bed, suddenly I can read it. And then I went out to my friend. We used to go out to play on the road, and I told my pal at the time, Deirdre, that I could read. And she brought out a book she had, which was Noddy and Tessie Bear. Asked me to demonstrate, and I could read it. And I went into her garden, and she got me to read it for her mother. And she was very, you know, pleasantly surprised and impressed. But I got one word wrong. There are a lot of wild animals in the book. I haven't seen that one for years. And I mixed up the word. I read circus instead of zoo, or zoo instead of circus, it probably was, which, I mean, they're completely different words, but I think that kind of demonstrates something about the way I was reading. I wasn't reading phonetically or the sounds. I must have been recognizing the whole words or something.
Yeah, the shape.
Yeah. So Mrs. Talbot was her name. She very gently corrected that for me. But I always remember it. And then I was just reading whatever I could get my hands on, which wasn't a huge amount. We didn't own books, but I joined the library, the public in near where I lived. And I used to go there and read voraciously.
And were you free to choose whatever you wanted? I know for a lot of people at that point, you had quite a lot of probably more freedom than children would have now in the book choices. You know, were you kept to one area, like this is for 5 to 9 year olds, or were you free to kind of borrow books from anywhere, really?
Well, in the library, the public library in Rathmines had a children's library upstairs. So you were confined to that, but that was for children of all ages. So you were free to choose whatever was there, but you didn't have access to the grown-up library, which was the downstairs part of the library, which of course I joined in due course. But but there was no absolutely no guidelines or advice or anything. You just picked whatever book you liked the look of off the shelves. Now, most people like the look of books by one writer, Enid Blyton, and they were actually never on the shelves because they didn't make it to the shelves. There was some sort of system going where children would somehow manage to swap. If you had an Enid Blyton, you kind of held on to it till you checked it back. Then I think the librarian put it on the trolley. So you took it off again and you exchanged. So it took me a long time to get into that the swapping of the Enid Blyton books, because I didn't go to there was one big school, St. Louis Rathmines, and the children from that school would descend on Rathmines Library in hordes when they got out. And they, of course, they knew each other and so on. But I went to a different school and I was on my own, and I wasn't part of that bartering group. So I had to take whatever I could find. All the other books were essentially left over.
And so, you said you were in a different school there. What was it? What was your school experience like then? Were you sort of separated from your primary school peers to go somewhere else, or what was your?
You know, I went to an Irish language school, School of Rita. So I had friends in the school, but we didn't live all in the same area.
Okay.
Whereas, I'm sure children went to other schools as well, but an awful lot of the children in Rathmines and Ranelagh went to St. Louis.
Okay. Like, so far, like, I'm just hearing, like, Enid Blyton, were you reading, like, Mallory Towers and all that kind of thing around that age as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. After a year or two, I at some stage, I started to get the Enid Blyton books. And, yeah, I love them. Mallory Towers, the Twins at St. Clair's, all those. Yeah, especially, I suppose, the school stories, but the Five Findouters and all that. And all those, you know, the Bobsey Twins, not Enid Blyton, Nancy Drew, all those children's books I loved. I love them. And at home, I had those little red classics.
I recognize that those spines. Like, just for our listeners, when you were showing me the hardback book there, I recognize that kind of the dull sort of reddy burgundy kind of hardback What Kitty Did, What Kitty Did Next, and all of that kind of thing. Even from the library, I can remember seeing them with the and you still have those copies.
They possibly had dust wrappers on them at once, you know, but I can't remember. I can't remember if they had or not. Anyway, they've been long lost.
I was going to say, is it strange because, like, I'm listening to all the titles, and I think, you know, for a lot of us, you know, until quite recently, the books that we read when we were younger were, like, they were English boarding schools, a very English kind of setting as well, like the Enid Blyton stories of, you know, Mallory Towers, Girls at St. Clair's, What Kitty Did, and everything like that. Was there a book when you started to, you know, as you were maturing and kind of coming into puberty, was there a book that, I don't know, that maybe grounded you in Irish culture, or in, I don't know, or that brought you a sense of where your roots were?
Not very much. I continue to read English American. I mean, Little Women was a huge influence on me when I was 9 or 10. Again, I remember coming across that, a copy of the book in a cottage in Glenvar in the Gaeltacht. Imagine, it belonged to some friends of mine who were also on holidays up there, and I found it there, and I could, you know, I just couldn't believe how wonderful this was. So I always think it's ironic that here I am in the Gaeltacht reading Little Women. But I read some of the Irish books I remember. It wasn't exclusively English. I love Patricia Lynch, the Brogan books, and The Bookshop and The Key, and The Turf Cutter's Donkey, and I think that's one of hers as well, and all of those. But actually, there weren't a lot of books for young people located in Ireland. At least I didn't come across them in those days. I seem to remember that whole flowering of literature for children and young people in Ireland happened really in the 70s and the 80s. Everything changed. Mm-hmm. For me it was really almost exclusively a diet of English books and American, like Nancy
and
Grew.
And did you always know then when you were in secondary school, did you always know or feel that you were going to go on and study literature? Is that something that was there early on? You were such a reader and probably a writer at that point as well, maybe. I don't know. Were you writing a little bit in secondary?
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I had decided very early on that that's the way I was going to go. Yeah.
When did you start putting ideas down on the page? What kind of period, or do you remember?
Yes, I do remember. I started when I was 8 or 9 in school, but it was always associated with school. I don't remember doing anything much at home. I wrote. I was encouraged in the primary school and also in the secondary school to write. I was good at writing, you know, and I realized I had a knack for it pretty early on, kind of to my surprise, and maybe to the teacher's surprise, because I was very shy and quiet child, you know. And I remember the very first story we wrote in class, that she sort of picked it up and read it out, and I was surprised. I thought it was so easy to do, and surprised that it was not everyone seemed to be doing that. But I know that's related to the constant reading. So I wrote. They often asked me to write a play. Because, then everyone can, lots of people can perform in the play. So the first one I wrote in cooperation with a friend, Cliona, in 4th or 5th class, I think. It was a terrible play, and it was heavily influenced by Mallory Towers and that sort of thing. But I'm sure the poor teacher who recommended it was, you know, had been hoping for something better, but we did it anyway.
It's interesting that it's play, though, isn't it? And it's often kids are like children in imagination. It's so imaginative play. It's often a little play. It's often a little drama or theatre. That's really interesting. I wonder how that feeds into narrative later on. You know, that you're engaging with character and it's quite, and it's dynamic, and it's not so, you know, it's all interior later, but it's an interesting way that that's how it starts, isn't it? As a child, it's externalized.
I think it's, my memory is not that I would have naturally gravitated towards the writing place, but that's what was required.
That's what you were told to do, basically. Yeah, we need the whole class involved here, Eilish. Yeah. So, but that's still incredible, though, that you were fifth class, sixth class, like so young starting, but and that kept going then through secondary school. That you were, but it was, you say it was all kind of school focused. So maybe it would have been, you know, write a short story, or write an essay, or write. So that's where, that's what it was. But you weren't at any, at this stage, it wasn't an outlet at that point for anything else.
No, I think I might have tried to, or wrote a few stories, all right, after the intercert. So yeah, when I was 14 or 15, during the long summer holidays, I began to write some stories, because I either that year or fifth year, I was beginning to think I should try writing myself.
And no bad love poetry at this point, because a lot of terrible poetry gets written around the teenage years
I don't remember. I'm sure I do remember being in love, so probably I did.
Probably something there. But hasn't seen the light of day. So you went on, I know you went on to UCD, is that right? UCD, you went on to study, study pure English.
Yes.
And what, I suppose that, so that felt like not like a given, but that was quite a direct path for you. There was no sort of, you weren't in any kind of quandary about what to do. You were quite clear.
Yes, I was quite clear, which was, I was lucky, wasn't I? Because it's so hard for young people to choose, I know, sometimes. But I was absolutely clear. And I thought, because I wanted to be a writer, so I thought that the best way to go about doing that was to read everything that had been written in English. I had a very narrow focus in one sense, but of course I had, because everything I read was in English, all the novels and novels, of course, mainly that I liked. So that was my plan. There was no, I'm sure if I also thought about being a journalist, and I think I did apply for the journalism course. There was one in Rathmines, but I didn't get a place there. So I don't know. I might have done that if I had. So
goodness, that would be a very different direction, wouldn't it? Journalism.
Would have been. Yeah. You see, it's sometimes you even forget these divergences and crossroads that happen almost by chance, and your life goes in one direction rather than another. Journalism would have been completely different, wouldn't it? But an awful lot of writers of fiction,
of course, yes,
journalists.
But because it feels to me that you were always interested in language anyway, whether it's English or Irish. You did middle English, is that right, as well? You studied
pure English basically means the straightforward major in modern English literature. And then for your other subjects, you do Old and Middle English.
Right. Okay. So you did.
So there wasn't much of a. But an awful lot of Old and Middle English. In those days, everyone did a bit of Old and Middle English, even as part of the English course. But again, my life went in a different direction thanks to that, because it included, they offered this module, as we would now call it, on the folktale and medieval literature, which opened up a whole new area for me and changed my life. So again, one of those, chance.
So at this fork, at this juncture, when this is all opening up, I know a lot of things are happening for you then, but is there a book from that, it's hard to choose one, but is there a book from that period of your life, college and your degree and maybe your master's or around there, you're talking about folklore, is there a particular book that was instrumental?
No, not sure. I guess books that had an impact on where I went in life were The Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer, which we, of course, studied in English, but as part of the English course, but in the folklore course, we looked at a number of the Canterbury tales, because Chaucer used oral folk tales as the basis for the Merchant's Tale, the Partner's Tale, the Friar's Tale, which I did my PhD on, and others. So yeah, I would have to say that in my sort of scholarly and academic life, that was a turning point. I think but I was writing short stories as well, and I think the books on the English course which had the most influence on me and which I liked most were actually D.H. Lawrence, The Rainbow and Women in Love, and those which we read. As I recall, in first year, but maybe also in third year, and I loved them, the style and the beautiful, rich language, the focus on nature, sexuality, obviously always of interest to somebody age 18 or 19, and his kind of forensic exploration of love and human relationships. So they would have been hugely important. That's what I remember. You know, I forget quite a lot.
That's the thing. When you look back, it's hard. I mean, there's some things that kind of like, there's a lot of things that probably are like sills that you can't recall that perhaps were important at the time, but they've kind of vanished, especially if you read an awful lot.
Well, this is it. If you just are reading all the time, because I think having copies of the books is a good, you know, they're good mementos. But sometimes, because I began to think over the last few days of writers that I enjoyed when I was a teenager, and I started thinking about Somerset Maugham. I hadn't thought about him for years, and then I realized, gosh, I adored Somerset Maugham, but because I haven't got I must have borrowed the books from the library, you know, The Razor's Edge and Lies of Lambeth and The Paint. I absolutely loved him, but I haven't read him for years. I'd probably go back now and see. That's always an interesting experiment, but I adored Somerset Maugham, for instance.
I wonder, would it be possible to retrieve your library record, you know, for any of us pre-digitally, if you could retrieve wouldn't that be lovely though? Imagine you could go back and see what you were borrowing from the library when you were 10 or 12 or 14 or 16 and see, like, title by title. That would be incredible.
I bet people will be able to do that now with the digital record, I imagine, but I can't imagine that they would
be able to trace it. I'd love to do that. But like, you're right, that Billy Collins poem, you know, the name of the author is the first to go, and then the title, and then the whole book evaporates, and you just remember a sort of feeling of something, you know, when someone says, did you read that book, and you kind of go, oh yeah, that was sort of, was it Paris, was it a sort of a dark thing, and that's all you can remember, you know, you don't remember the, and then you think as a writer, all those intricacies that someone has spent 2 years agonizing over, and you can't even remember the name of the author or the main character or
main character. It's very frustrating. Yeah, I mean, it is. I have a friend who writes a little summary of all the books he reads as he goes along, and I try to do that now from time to time, but I mean,
it's a really good idea. I think I start that.
It's a really good idea.
Every year I think I'm going to take a picture of the book and I'll put it somewhere, like on social media, so it's my own record, but I think I do about four and then I forget, and then it's like, wow.
Yeah, I'm like that too.
Sorry, went off a wee bit there on a tangent, but I know, and I don't know whether you're comfortable talking about this, Eilish. I mean, obviously, I know you've written a whole book about loss and your marriage and everything else, but I don't want to pry. So I know, as a public figure, sometimes people ask very private questions. So if you're not comfortable talking about it, that's fine. I'm not sure of my details here, but you met your husband around PhD time, is that right? Your late husband.
Yes.
And we're I I imagine that books were incredibly important to both of you.
Oh, absolutely! Yes,
obviously,
he was a terrible reader, because I have his library, which is almost a burden at this stage. Simply because there's so many books.
You have his library. You have, right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, his part of his library is my library.
Your
as
library.
Well. Yeah, I do have a problem with space for books in my house. he was a great reader. He Boo read the whole time. Yeah, he was always reading. Yeah, so I know I have a photo of us waiting to get married, both actually reading. Yeah, waiting, and he never minded. He liked to be early, actually, for planes and trains and so on. And it doesn't really matter. You can, if you're sitting there with your book, you know.
Yes.
So, but Boo wasn't. Well, he was very learned, actually. He wasn't that involved in reading contemporary literature. He read all the great classics and in several languages, actually, but he wasn't involved in contemporary Irish literature or that very much, you know. It was more the Middle Ages and classics and history and obviously folklore. He was folklorist, so the whole academic area, but the folklore area. But yeah, we had that absolutely in common, which is a great thing. You know, I find it hard to imagine having a partner who wouldn't be interested in reading.
No, I know. I
mean, and he wasn't interested in sports, which was great, really.
God.
Because I don't really like you know how men watch football matches very often, and it's just such there was none of that.
And did you have would you have so you were reading probably quite disparate things then? Would you have had lots of discussions? And
well, we had the whole area of folklore studies in common. So, I mean, we were reading in the same area there. And no, actually, when I say he didn't read, there were some writers that we both loved, like David Lodge. So we were always getting the latest David Lodge novel and reading it. I suppose that those campus novels had a certain attraction for him, but all of them. And he also introduced me to... he was Swede from Sweden, so Swedish literature. So we would discuss some of the Swedish books, especially, I guess, again, the classics like novels by Selma Lagerlöf, the first woman to win the Nobel Prize, who Boo liked her work, and I did as well, and still do very much. So, yeah, and... I became, well, one of my favourite contemporary Swedish authors. It was Henning Mankell, who wrote the Wallander books, you know, the detective ones. I'm not sure, Boo didn't really read them very much, but I liked them because I could read them with ease when in Swedish detective. They're very, this is something that I have found out about foreign languages. The easiest ones to read are usually detective novels, crime fiction. Because the vocabulary is kind of fairly limited once you get over the crime vocabulary. and they're also, if they're good, and the Henning Mankell ones are fantastically good, you know, you just want to read to the end. You can't put them down because you want to find out
That's brilliant, actually. Yeah, that's actually a really good tip. And it's a really good tip for somebody learning. Because like quite often you start with another language, you start on text. Like, you know, if you're reading French, they give you bonjour, tristesse. Or if you're reading Italian, they give you, or you start with, but it's actually, that makes an awful lot more sense to start with something. Yeah, to start with a detective novel, something pacey. And that's, I actually, Mike, that's a good tip for resurrecting my Italian,
you should be reading Maigret, not Maupassant.
No.
Or at least you can start.
That's really good. And you write detective, or am I wrong? No, I could be wrong. Do you write detective novels or crime novels in Irish? Is that right? Yes.
I've written two or three. And that's why the very first one I wrote was a crime novel, Dún Vrú Sadangan, maybe about 2000, and Murder in Dingle. And I wrote it precisely because I had made this discovery about Henning Mankell, and that, I thought, I write something that people might like to read and that they will be able to read. And I did the crime novel. So, and then I did a few more as well. And people did read it. It was a bestseller, which is not a huge amount, but it was 3,000 or something, that kind of, that's really a bestseller. So, it was inspired by my experience with the novels of Henning Mankell.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to ask you, Alicia, I know people probably ask you a lot about loss and grief, so I want to ask you first about laughter and solace and comfort and book or books that maybe you go to for that, or if you do, you know, do you read humorous books, or do you read poetry, or do you read, you know, sometimes people choose very, very odd things that bring them comfort, like an Encyclopedia of Penguins or something, but like, is there a book that you gravitate towards if you're feeling down, or if you're feeling a bit lost? Are there books that kind of help with that or not?
Well, in a general way, absolutely comfort books. And I think somebody advised me once, even if you're going on a trip or a holiday, bring a comfort book as well as, you know, the new books you want to read with you. I would go back just to old favorites the whole time. And they would be people like Margaret Drabble, David Lodge, Alice Munro, the great short story writer. I reread her the whole time, and I find them kind of comforting in the wise tone, that there's a kind of wise tone in the stories, and a rhythm or something that I like. But when in time of real difficulty and loss, like when my husband died, I found that the grief books that other people had written were quite consoling in some way, and I wondered why that was, but they definitely were helpful to me. I know it's not like that for everyone in that situation, because sometimes I've given them to other people and they don't want to read them, or they can't. Yeah. But I mean, Joan Didion, The Year of Magical Thinking, and Joyce Carol Oates, The Widow's Story, Widow's Tale, and Julian Barnes, Levels of Life, and those kind of books. I found them somehow helpful. Yeah, in the sense of being with. I mean, I am a middlebrow reader. I think I'm not. I love lovely language. I was reading Death in Venice over the last few days, just because the actor who played the boy in Death in Venice, Bjorn Andreasen, he played Tadeo. He died two or three days ago, at the age of 70, I think. And he had his story is interesting and tragic. But I went back then to Death in Venice, and I'm just so bowled over by the language. It's so rich and fantastic, whatever your attitude to the morals of it, which are kind of in question, I think, at this point. But it's lovely. But it's very accessible, of course. It's real. Mm. It's realism. So I think that's what I like most and what I find comforting. Now, I've lost my train of thought. Why was I saying that?
So we're talking about books that you can go to for, but I think consolation is a nicer word than comfort. But I'm
consolation, or sympathy, that sense of in the good grief books, an awful lot of rubbish. Actually, I mean, it's probably not very nice to say that, but the Joan Didion, Joyce Carol Oates, and C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis, I was going to say, Grief Observed is
that's fantastic. Yeah, I loved that one.
And has, I think, stood the test of time. I mean, it doesn't change.
It has stood absolutely, exactly. Beautiful writing and so honest and profound and somehow really amazingly good.
It's naked, but it's. I was wondering about your own writing on your own tone, because I was saying to you before we started that I've got your selected stories here, which are stories from, I suppose, from throughout your life. And you were chatting to me there, you were mentioning like writers that you like that have a wise tone, or we've talked a little bit, just touched on, because I don't want to take you there, but on the loss and the death of Boo. Do you recognise in your own voice, like when you read a story that you wrote 20 years ago, 30 years ago or more, and then you read something later on, once you've been through that kind of, I don't know how you would explain, through that awful sort of purifying, but that sort of fire that people go through and they come out the other side and they're a completely different person, but they're changed, completely changed. Mm-hmm. Do you see that change in your, can you recognise it in your writing? Or can you say, oh, that was the before and that is the after, when you're looking at your own work?
Yeah, that's I'm not sure if I can, to be honest. Yes, I suppose you would hope, as a person and as a writer, that you do gain insight and wisdom as you age. But I'm not. I wonder if the writing can get a little bit plainer and less concerned with, proving. Well, I think that does happen. I mean, at a certain point, you don't have, you're not proving anything to anybody, which I think as a young writer you are doing sometimes, and you have to do it to get published and to win attention and so on and so forth. I would say at this stage in my life that's not a particular concern, and I would just like to write as honestly as I can. I'm still kind of philosophical and still, I suppose, trying to explore what it means to be human and what is good in humanity and that sort of thing. So I think from now on I will be in a way more concerned with those sort of issues, and not so, I often in my, or sometimes, frequently, I was rather, I would say, sneery and critical of people and so on in stories, and glib, perhaps a little bit glib, and especially maybe in the humorous stories where I'm sending up something, in a way for comic effect. Well, I'm not saying that I'll never do that again. Probably I will, but perhaps there might be that change. I mean, in the stories that maybe we are thinking about, like the coast of Wales and New Zealand flax, they were written not long, you know, a year or two after my husband died, and they're about bereavement and so on, and grief, really. It's now nearly 12 years, actually, since Boo died. So it's a long time ago. But for the first year or two, I didn't want to write fiction at all. I just couldn't be bothered. And it seemed really trivial and that. So, but I got back into it. I wrote the whole time my memoir and also reviews for the Irish Times, who were great about keeping me in the loop. I'm grateful to Fintan O'Toole, who was the book's editor, and Martin Doyle for that right through. So, you know, I kept my hand in. And then Sinead Cleason asked me to write a story for her fantastic anthology, The Long Gaze Back, and that got me back into it. But I wrote about the visit to the graveyard, you know. So, and around the same time, or very soon afterwards, Belinda McKeown asked me for a story for A Kind of Compass, is the title of her anthology. And I wrote in the New Zealand flax, another kind of grief ghost story for that, and then I was back into writing again. But yeah, I'm not a great analyst of my own writing. It is strange, you know, going through those selected stories, even selecting them, I found quite hard to do.
It's, and I suppose once it goes off, it becomes its own little boat, doesn't it? It's someone else's. When it reaches them, it's their story then, I suppose, in some ways, as the reader.
Yeah, I think an aspect of short stories is that you know, over a lifetime of writing, there are so many of them that It's so easy for me to completely forget certain stories. I mean, when I open some of those old books, I remember more or less the titles, but when I read them, I have no recollection of them at all. Whereas I think with the novels, it may be different if you are an Agatha Christie, it probably is, but you know, because they're bigger and you don't write so many of them and so on, you have a reasonably accurate memory of what you wrote and why you wrote it, possibly even that. But the short stories, sometimes now for interviews and so on, and for, you know, selecting a few stories here and there for anthologies, I have to go through them, and I'm just surprised.
Like reading someone else's words, someone else's voice.
It's as if somebody else wrote them, and in fact, somebody else did write them. In one sense. I mean, I know there but you change over time, of course. Yeah.
And would you say the short story is, not that you have a favourite child, but if you had to choose between writing novels or writing novellas or writing a short story, would it be the short story that's closest to you?
Yes, I think I think I would have to answer yes to that question. And I think maybe the long short story is what I like to write, a novella. But, you know, I have an ambition to write 100 short stories. I mean, I have written about 85 or 86, so it's not one of those kind of facetious ambitions, really. But I also love to lose myself in a novel. I mean, writing a novel is like reading a novel. Obviously, it takes an awful lot more time, which is one of the problems with it. I think when you you start it, you open it up, and then you immerse yourself in the world of the novel. And it's almost as if it's just there for you to get back into when you're writing it each time. Whereas the short stories, come and go. My practice as a writer is to slap the thing down as quickly as I can. And you can do that with the short story. Mm. Just write it while you've got it, while you want to write it, and then start rewrite it. But I feel unless I have the text there, I've nothing. With the novel, it's a bit harder to do it that way.
Yeah. While the fire is in your belly, sort of a thing. I know that.
While the fire's in your belly, while the spark, the Shelley quote, isn't it? The fire and the flint, yeah. While the coal is still lighting. Because with a novel, it fades. You can catch the short story and get it down while it's burning. But actually, with the novel, you have to rekindle it time and time again.
Over and over again.
That's the real challenge, I think, of novel writing, and possibly one of the reasons I find it harder to write novels.
And not to just dampen it out with working at it for so long as well, not to dampen it down or to change it too much that it just, poof, it's gone.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Exactly. No, you're right. Yeah, I think it's a real risk. And if you're, because of its relationship with time, i.e. that takes a lot of time, I think you need to be at it very regularly to keep that spark, kind of try and keep the spark going and to get rekindled, because you change in the sense that the interest that inspired the novel at the beginning, it will certainly sag in the middle, and you begin to think, why am I doing this?
It's a bit like a long-term relationship, but it's another C.S. Lewis line, you know, love is an act of will. It's like, it's writing a novel, it's an act of will sometimes, you know, it's not an emotion anymore. Eilish, I was going to ask you if you wanted to read for us, and I think we're going to read from one of the stories and select a stories, am I right? Or did we find that?
Well, I found the original version of it, which is in the coast of Wales.
Oh, brilliant.
It's in the Long Gaze Back, but I think it's one of the last stories in Selected.
I have to say my heart was in my mouth at one point in this story, and I'm very glad, I won't spoil it for the readers, but I'm very glad that it ended in the way that it did.
That's because you're a dog person.
I was actually going, no, you can't possibly do this. So yes, I'm glad. I love this one so much, Eilish. Beautiful story.
This is what the graveyard looks like, an enormous housing estate bisected by a thoroughfare. You can drive on this, and some people do, but I think that's inappropriate, like driving on a beach. Off this central artery are the cul-de-sacs, 20 on each side. Hundreds of straight lines of graves arranged symmetrically like boxy houses with pocket handkerchief lawns in front of each one. True, there is a certain amount of variation in the headstones, as there is in houses on estates, but as with them, diversity is limited by planning restrictions. The headstones must not be higher than 4 feet, and so they all measure exactly 4 feet. Naturally, everyone goes for as much height as they can get. Apart from this, some choice is permitted, although all headstone designs and inscriptions have to be vetted by the authorities. They're pretty tolerant. There are some unusual headstones around. You hesitate to use the words bad taste in connection with death. Another thing I've learnt, don't be judgmental about trivial things. And everything is trivial by comparison with what's going on in this place. But I can't warm to the shiny slabs with gold inscriptions and smoke angels on top. The white marble is nicer, even when it comes with expressions of profound sentiments in lines apparently purloined from country and western songs or the funny stories page of some ancient schoolboy magazine. His life a beautiful memory, his absence a silent grief. take care of Tom Lord as he did us, with lots of love and little fuss. My favourites are the simple stones, plain grey, which have become more common, I'm pleased to report, over the past 4 or 5 years. It's easy to date fashions in a graveyard. That's what I ordered for you, the style called Boulder, the natural look that suits a man who wore tweed and spoke correct Irish, Welsh and Scots Gaelic. I thought it was a personal choice, but I've discovered that most of the poets and writers, teachers and academics in the graveyard are buried under similar stones. There's only one unique monument in the entire place, a wide slab of pinkish granite, thin as a butterfly's wing, only a name and a date inscribed on it in tiny Times New Roman. The architect who designed Belfield, but of course.
You've been listening to The Laureate for Irish Fiction, Éilis na Gcuimhne. See you all next time.